Today is Wednesday, March 27, 2024. It's 8 a.m. We do have a quorum. So today I am going to have the House Education Committee call to order. It is exactly 8 a.m. We are meeting in the Davis Room, 160 in the Capitol Building. Juno, please silence all your cell phones or turn them off to all the members in the public and on the committee. The staff assisting us today is Linda with LIO, Susan with Records, and committee aide Eugene Hernet. The following members are present is Representative Prox, Representative Story, Representative McKay, Representative Hemshute, Representative Vice Chair or Co-Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Allard. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Today's agenda, our first and item on today's agenda to bring forward is HB 392, Education Funding by Representative McKay. Before this committee, this is the first hearing on the bill. Would the sponsor please come to the table? Please state your name and the record and present your bill, along with your staff, and I believe the staff member is Trevor Jepson. It's not here yet. Did we need to take a brief at ease? Are you ready? We could. Okay. You ready?
We're ready.
All right. Go ahead and begin your presentation, please.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Co-Chair and members of the House Education Committee. It's our privilege to be with you this morning to discuss House Bill 392 relating to Alaska education funding. As you might recall, during our House floor session, I guess it was a week and a half ago or so, we had a pretty major vote on the governor's veto. And my floor speech, I had indicated that we would be presenting an alternative. And this is it. So here we are. So I wanted to just make that introduction. I will now read the sponsor statement for version A. We're calling this version A because our plan is to have a committee substitute that would be a little bit different, and that would be version B. So just so there's no confusion. So in the ever-evolving educational landscape of Alaska, the importance of supporting our students, educators, and schools has never been more critical. House Bill 392, introduced by the House Resources Committee, is a comprehensive piece of legislation designed to address several key areas in our educational system. Alaska currently ranks near the bottom of educational outcomes in the United States, and we owe it to our kids and parents to come up with solutions and educational options. This bill addresses multiple facets of our state's education system, including public school funding, charter schools, and correspondence programs. House Bill 392 is a testament to Alaska's commitment to its future generations. By addressing the pressing needs of our educational system through comprehensive funding and support measures, we are not only investing in the educational success of our students, but also in the economic and social well-being of our state. As the chair of the House Resources Committee and the de facto sponsor of HB 392, I urge my colleagues in the legislature to support this bill, understanding that the benefits it brings will resonate throughout our communities, laying a stronger foundation for the future of education in Alaska. So with that, I'll turn it over to my chief of staff, Trevor Jepson, who will give you a presentation on the bill.
Thank you,
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. And I just wanted to, 804 Representative McCormick joined us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Thank you, Co-Chair Allard and the rest of the House Education Committee for being here today to hear this presentation on HB 392 relating to Alaska education funding. Alaska currently and historically has lagged behind in education outcomes, consistently ranked near the bottom by the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, which is the largest nationally representative and continuing assessment of what students in public and private schools in the U.S. are able to do in various subjects. According to research by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, the importance of education is at an all-time high. With technological progress swiftly eliminating jobs that require fewer skills, the ramifications of a subpar education will significantly impact today's youth and their future socioeconomic status. With over 76 million students currently attending schools across the U.S., education is not just about acquiring knowledge, it's a pathway to job prospects, economic security, and autonomy. However, there's a varying degree of readiness across states when it comes to equipping the future workforce for success. Some states are leading the charge, while others are falling short, and unfortunately, Alaska is in the latter category. HB 392 represents an education omnibus funding package that Rep. McKay believes is in the best interests of our students and teachers. The base student allocation, or the BSA, is the dollar amount that's multiplied by a district's adjusted average daily membership, also referred to as adjusted ADM, in the Education Foundation formula when calculating projected basic need funding. Rampant inflation over the last few years, including roughly 5% in 2021 and a staggering 8% in 2022, justifies a relatively significant increase to the base student allocation as the cost of everything has gone up for districts. In recent years, the state has relied more on one-time funding outside the formula, including $30 million in FY20, $57 million in FY23, and roughly $88 million in FY24. While this has helped the issue with the inflation and the lack of funding from the state for schools, continued reliance on one-time funding doesn't provide the best level of stability for districts when crafting their budget. HB 392 proposes a $680 increase to the BSA from $5,960 to $6,640, representing a roughly 11.5% increase. An increase of $680 also represents the largest one-year increase to the BSA in the history of the Education Foundation formula. Charter schools in Alaska represent a bright spot on our education system. Charters are actually public schools and represent a form of public school choice. Alaska Charter School was recently ranked number one in the nation, with student test scores in reading and math being over 32% of a standard deviation higher than the national average for all students. One standard deviation represents being roughly 3 years ahead of the average, so on average, Alaska Charter School students test a year ahead of their peers nationwide. To give just a little bit more context on charter schools and their populations, we'll go over what the program looks like in our state's largest school district, which is ASD. ASD has a little over 40,000 students enrolled district-wide, with roughly 3,500 of those students currently in charter schools, and another 2,300 kids on the waiting list for a charter school. Parents want more options for public school, and charter schools represent that. HB 392 introduces a new pathway for charter school termination appeals and introduces a state charter school coordinator position that would be focused on providing support to both potential and currently operating charter schools.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank Representative Frank Tomaszewski for joining us. Continue.
Co-Chair Allard. The state of Alaska has over 30 correspondence programs when counting both statewide and local programs, and roughly 20,000 correspondent students. Under current statute, the state applies a factor of 0.9 times the ADM of the district's correspondent students when calculating the district's total adjusted ADM. HB 392 would fund them at 1.0 instead of 0.9. So just for a little example of that, if our hypothetical school district has 10 correspondent students, multiply that by 0.9, only 9 students would end up in the full number of the adjusted ADM, which is then multiplied by the BSA. Next, we'll go over the Alaska Reads Act funding portion of the bill. The Alaska Reads Act was a landmark piece of legislation passed in the 32nd legislature and signed by Governor Dunleavy in June 2022. The bill focused on advancing reading levels for K through 3 students and was based on programs nationwide that have had a proven success record. However, many labeled the policy an unfunded mandate, especially in rural Alaska, due to a lack of specified funds and statute. We're not here today to debate the veracity of that opinion. However, HB 392 puts that criticism to bed by providing additional funds in the form of $500 per three student that's been determined to have a reading deficiency to help fund those reading improvement plans. The final funding aspect of the bill is transportation funding. HB 392 updates transportation funding for students. These funds only apply to public school students and not correspondence students. The last increase to transportation funding was in FY 2013, and HB 392 represents a roughly 18% increase for transportation funding across the board. And thank you, Coach Allard. That concludes the presentation. With your permission, we can do the sectional.
If there's no objection, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So Section 1 amends 1403-127A, which would allow schools qualifying for internet services, discounted internet services, to receive funding for 100 megabits per second, up from 25 megabits per second. As Representative McKay referenced in his opening statement, we are already working on a CS. That portion of Version A wasn't mentioned in the bill because we're taking that out for the CS. Section 2 adds a new section allowing charter schools to appeal to the Commissioner of Deed if they're terminated by a local school board, representing an alternate path that doesn't have to go just through the local school board. Section 3 adds a new section establishing the charter school coordinator position, which, as mentioned in the presentation, is aimed at helping both currently operating charter schools and also potential charter schools that are in the application process. Section 4 repeals the previous 1409-010A, which is transportation funding, that was established in FY13, and updates it with that 18% increase roughly across the board. Section 5 amends AS 1417-430, which would increase the adjusted ADM factor for correspondence students from 0.9 to 1. Section 6 increases the BSA by $680 to a total of $6,640. Section 7 adds a new section that would provide $500 for each K through 3 student that is ranked as deficient in reading. Section 8 establishes teacher recruitment and retention incentives for certified full-time teachers. Section 9 provides for an immediate effective date for Section 1, which was the Internet Funding for Schools portion of Version A. And Section 10 provides an effective date of July 1st, 2024 for Sections 2 through 8. And Co-Chair Allard, if we could go into the suggested changes for the committee substitute, I think that could clarify things for the record and the public of what the bill is going to look like.
And you're going to clarify this, and then we're going to – the CS just isn't ready right now.
Co-Chair Allard, that is correct. We're still waiting to get the CS back from legal.
I wanted to thank Representative Ortiz for joining us today, and go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So Section 1, we are suggesting to remove entirely. That's the funding for internet schools. There's a different vehicle for that, HB 193, that's already passed both bodies. In Section 2, we would like to replace commissioner with state board relating the state charter school appeal process. So the decisions wouldn't just be up to the commissioner. The State Board of Education would be involved in that appeals process. Section 5, we're recommending using a special needs factor of 1.2 for the ADM-based correspondence funding instead of the factor of 1. Which would represent a 20% increase in correspondence funding from the current version of the bill. Section 7, instead of doing 500 for all students K through 3 with a reading deficiency, we're recommending just doing a flat 180 across the board and an additional $100 for K through 3 students in a Title I school. Just for clarification, Title I schools are schools that have an abnormally high portion of lower-income students, which is measured in the number of students on the reduced or free lunch program. Section 8, the lump sum payment for teacher incentives, we're recommending to remove that entirely. While Rep. McKay does believe that policy could be effective, it's proven highly controversial in this legislature, and for the pragmatic effect of trying to get this bill passed, we're just recommending to remove that section. And then finally, we are going to add a new section, which includes state board authorized charter school language under 1403-254. And there is a current vehicle for that by Co-Chair Ruffridge, HB 391, if anybody would like to get a pre-look at what that language would look like. Thank you, Co-Chair Allard.
Thank you. And I just wanted to let everybody know that we also have Dr. Bishop here, the Commissioner to Deed, as invited testimony, Karen Morrison, Director of Finance and Support Services, and Deb Riddle, Operations Manager, Innovation and Education Excellence. Is there any members of the committee who have questions for the sponsor and their presentation? Representative Hemshoot.
Chair Allard, I have a ton of questions. Will there be an opportunity to ask those after invited testimony?
I think that if you ask the question, if we need to have invited testimony up, or would you like them to come first?
Co-Chair Allard, yeah, I believe it would probably be most appropriate for the commissioner or her staff to answer a lot of these policy questions.
All right, so let's just take a brief at ease and we could swap really quick and have them up first. Brief at ease. Back to order. We're going to go ahead and if you could put your names on the record, where you work, and then we're going to go in with some questions for your team.
Excellent. Thank you, Co-Chair Allard, for having us here and for the bill sponsor as well. My name is Dina Bishop, the Commissioner of Education. I also want to just thank you for allowing me to speak, and if I don't get another chance, just have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Karen Morrison, and I serve as the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education and Early Development.
And I'm Deborah Riddle, and I am the Division Operations Manager for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence.
All right, we're going to start off with Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. So some of my questions may have to do with the CS that we don't have. Should I hold those? Will there be a chance to ask those questions when we have the CS?
There will be a chance to ask those questions of the CS, but if I think it would be smarter just to wait till the CS was in front of us.
Great. Then let me just dig into
if you dabble over there, I don't think anybody's going to object to it, though.
Okay. I'm a little bit unclear on the correspondence study, but I think my lack of clarity comes from the changes that might be in the CS. So basically, what we have in front of us right now is the old SB 140 with the teacher bonuses added in. Is that correct?
If Commissioner Bishop wants to, I guess you could go ahead and speak, and then maybe they can ask you questions from what you say.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Hemshoot. CS, as described and as we see in bullet number three or arrow number three, is 1.2 for ADM-based correspondence funding. And this is supported in so far as the 0.2 actually speaks to services to students. When you look at our formula, it has several steps in the algorithm. The first two steps are primarily for the system, if you will. They speak to the cost area differentials around Alaska that we value different, you know, the cost is different around Alaska. So we multiply depending on the CPIU. The second is school size. Alaska's formula values smaller schools. The larger your school, actually the less funds you get per student over a certain amount of students. When you start on the third multiplier, that speaks to services to students. And so in so much as correspondence students are students, this change actually supports the learning of students rather than the first two categories of the cost area differential and the school base. So those services are ELL, career technical education, gifted, and general SPED, not intensive. But given that correspondent students have those characteristics and those services, that multiplier was added to identify those services that those students could partake in.
So it's not in the current bill, it's in the CS. So let's go ahead and go there. I need to understand, are we going from 0.9 to 0.1 plus a 1.2 special needs factor?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshoot, it would be the 1.2. It would be specifically every child's treated as a whole child, you know, given that they represent one whole, the Mr. Jepson shared in regard to how that's calculated. You know, if you had 10 kids, you really only have 9. Now you fully do have really 10 students. And those students would also qualify for student needs services, which is in the special services category, special needs category.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. So the special needs category, this multiplier that we put in, is generally a block grant, and districts have to have a plan of service. So how is the plan of service rendered with individual families being the educators?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Hemshute. When a student is in public school correspondence, it is actually articulated quite well in regulations. There are meetings with a teacher that sets up an individualized learning plan, or an ILP, that speaks to the type of services students need. That's generally gathered through assessment, which we know the reading assessment occurs, math assessment occurs. So the selection of services, textbooks, curriculum, whether that be for PE and art to services for special education, they're all determined through the ILP. And from my experience, and most recently in the Anchorage School District, most of those services for special education actually are rendered back to the district, because they want not only special services, but other classes as well. They're serviced through the district. And so a lot of those funds, all the funds go directly to parents for those services. Through the ILP, it's determined, and then you understand the costs of all those things.
Through the chair.
Of course.
Will the CS contain any guardrails on that additional funding being used for the allotment or not used for the allotment that families receive? So I guess what I'm getting at is, if this expense is falling to districts to provide music programming and special education services and maybe English language services and maybe even gifted services, that's the home district's burden. And so would the 1.2 go to the home district and not be allowed to be used to increase the allotment?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute, that's a great question. But presently at this time, the homeschool district, like you're speaking of, determines that allotment number. And so that, and these charter schools are located, these charter schools are located in districts that determine those costs. So the whole program resides right within the district.
What I'm going to do is rein this in, as nobody has the CS in front of them. So if we could speak to what we actually have in front of us, I think it's going to be a better conversation next week when we bring it in front of us, and it'll be more helpful for others. Is there any other questions that, besides the CS, that you would like to ask Representative Hemshue?
No, my questions pertain mostly to this bill is very familiar, since we've spent quite a bit of time on it on the floor and not so much in committee. But I'll let you know if I think of any. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other committee? Representative Story, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. And through the chair, and just to follow up on correspondence, students in general, because we have them and we appreciate them. They're part of our public schools. And when we do the special education plans for them, it's a legal obligation. And so we take it very seriously. And if there is ever like a legal suit or anything like that, it is the local district that is responsible. Like IDEA is the correspondence program. And Galena.
Sorry, do you have a question?
Yes. That was my question. I was just going to give an example of what I was talking about, but the district is responsible if there's any legal issue that comes up over special ed.
Through the Co-Chair Allard to Representative Story, you are correct.
Okay, thank you. And then I think my comment on a 20% increase with the special ed, and maybe it's just to the sponsor, with having our draft budget out right now, where would that money come from to pay for that extra 20%?
What we'll do is we'll wait for that question, if you don't mind, and then we can pull Trevor Jepson back up. Unless you guys want to go ahead and answer that. You want to wait?
Co-Chair Allard, we don't.
Okay, thank you. All right, are there any other questions for the, okay, Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. And this has to do with charter schools and our authorization, whether they're with the local school board through the commissioner. I'm not quite sure with the CS, because I believe you referenced that it would just be through state board authorization. My thought is, if it was just through state board authorization, who assesses the local impacts to the neighborhood schools? Since our finances are based on enrollment, so when our students in our public schools are using a charter school choice, then the neighborhood school has less students. And my concern is the impacts, because then they might lose choices such as a music or a CTE or something, because they have lost revenue because the kids go to the charter school. So who would be assessing the impacts to the local neighborhood schools?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Story, I'm not sure the local impacts to schools. Certainly we would understand like the educational impacts of what kids are learning, or economic impacts.
Follow up. Loss of like electives, because if you lose 30 kids who go off from a school, depending upon your school size, then they're going to have a less teacher in the neighborhood school. So then they're going to have to either cut an art class or music or a CTE or something in their academic program.
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Story, that actually the type of program that students and receive is really based at that local school, sometimes at the school level. I worked in three different districts throughout my career, and all of those electives and type things were quite different among all three of those. And so that would be very hard to track. I guess you could ask what changes occurred, but they don't start the same. So that would be very difficult to understand what the changes were, because all of our schools do not offer the same education. And I believe that is the core belief of our constitution, that they really are locally organized to be able to serve the area that they're in, including charter schools, including correspondence schools. So those types of additional programs aren't ubiquitous in every school already.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Isn't it true, though, that when you have less students, you have less money in your neighborhood school? So they have to look at what less offerings they are going to have?
Through Co-Chair Allard, Representative Story, when you lose students, I've had that in a very large school district where we've lost students, and you just have to make different choices. And some of those choices are through my tenure, I've had to close two schools. I've combined three programs into a school. So you make those choices to be able to continue to afford and do the things you want. It's a balance of choice about how you organize and prioritize. If your priority are those things, then you might not need as many buildings to have those things in. But sometimes if the priority is to have more schools, because schools are, as I said earlier, a funding unit, those are just the decisions need to be made. But overall, you look at the type of program you want for students and what kind of outcomes and how best to meet the students' needs.
Another question?
Yes. But my question is, how does the state board, certainly the local board, will look at that if they were authorizing, but if it goes to the state board, how does the state board know the impact on the neighborhood schools, the choices that they will be making if this charter school is opened and there's going to be projected enrollment in the charter school and there will be less enrollment in the neighborhood school? How does the state board get that information?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Story, my understanding is that the state board would work directly with the district and not only supporting charter schools, but also supporting all schools in Alaska.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hemchut.
Thank you, Chair Allard. Through the chair, I'm still digesting the suggestions in the current bill for correspondence study, and we're looking at a greater investment of the public dollar into our correspondence programs.
what is the accountability that's going to go along with that? So when we make that greater investment, is there an assurance that the ILP is followed? Is there an audit of that? How do we know that that investment is paying off? So, for example, we're measuring the neighborhood schools on test scores. Can we use that as a measure when we make this investment?
Through Representative or Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute, that's a great question, and actually that's already done. All schools in Alaska are accountable both financially as well as through our federal regulations of teacher counts, per pupil, expenditures, and success of students. And so that already exists within our accounting system for schools.
Follow up. Thank you, through the chair. So the ILPs that are written, I've heard of ratios of 90 to 1 because it's a homeschool program. And so there's one certified teacher writing up to 90 different ILPs. Is there any accountability surrounding the ILP and how closely that's monitored or how successful the students are based on their ILP?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute, I can just speak from experience that it is taken seriously in ILP, and homeschool parents believe in the education of their of the partnership and the education of their children as well. Again, they are within written within regulation. There's four meetings a year to come and check in. Some of those have to be as much as can be in person. It's a plan that's outlined. It's taken very seriously, similar to other plans that we work for students, like the reading plans and individualized education plans, IEPs. Certainly the law, the federal law, isn't regulated like it is on for special education students, but it is a contract and it's an agreement. And we're looking at a child moving them forward. And so within the districts for which I worked in, those were, I don't really see it different than a classroom teacher having a relationship with their students and parents in a school. This is just a relationship with students and parents that have more flexibility in the deliverance of education to their students.
Final comment?
Yes, go ahead.
Through the chair. So recognizing the rights of parents to withhold testing, we know that we have a 14% rate of testing in our correspondence programs. Do you consider that adequate for accountability purposes?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute, I'm not sure. I'd have to look at those numbers, but that is provided within the law of Alaska to, withhold. I don't know if I told the story, but in Anchorage, when that first law went out, we went ahead and did a study of our high schoolers, because we had a lot of high schoolers that opted out that year, ninth grade. And we just felt as though it was a significant amount. And when we did a regression study on that and all of our high schoolers, two high school scores we felt were impacted. However, they were not impacted because they were lower. If those students had tested, they would have been much higher. So what we assumed was that the higher end students were the ones who opted out, which is certainly maybe the value that they placed on testing. My doctorate is an assessment and performance. And so, of course, I'm a data nerd. I like to look at learning. I like to learn from it. I would encourage parents to see, and that's why I love the MAP growth so much, is that we do have for any assessment that is really welcomed with our homeschool parents, it's that MAP growth, because it demonstrates their students' ability according to their grade level, not only within our state and within our each district, but within the nation. And they find that highly valuable.
Comment?
Thank you. I'm gonna...
Okay. Just that the MAP also allows us to look at discrete skills and where a kid needs to improve. So the MAP has been a huge bonus.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Allard. I am kind of going to assume that what Representative Hemshute was trying to get at, when we enrolled our children into, we used the IDEA program, but the whole reason we did that was to get the assessments between, I don't remember, we'll call it the teacher, there was another word, and us, to make sure that we were on track. And so there was accountability from us to the IDEA program, if you will. But is there a way then to transmit that up to the state level so that the public knows that the IDEA program is somehow working? I think that's what I understood her to say. I don't know that we've quite connected.
But before you begin, I just want to welcome Representative Clone, and I also want to Representative Sumner has arrived to listen to what's going on.
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Prox, we do receive permission from districts to be able to share their map growth data in the aggregate, so that as a whole, which would demonstrate that success that you're talking about. Because again, that test given three times a year, for probably very similar reasons to you, to just keep their check of their student learning. I think especially families who choose homeschool, they're taking more of a personal investment in their children to be able to have this relationship and that experience of homeschooling them. So I really see that choice as something of in itself, something that they would want feedback on. So we could certainly do that. And presently we request scores to be shared for map growth as well.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I never paid attention to how all this was developed 30 years ago, but do the correspondence program follow some sort of a standard for the individual learning programs? We happen, I don't know what it was called at the time, but we figured it was some sort of standardized testing that everyone else was following. Is that required so that we could compare data between schools?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Prox. So correspondence schools are our public schools, and they do participate in the regular assessments that are given in Alaska schools. The ILP, the Individualized Learning Plan, they are based off of templates. The templates are based off of regulation. Now, each school district can design their own template. Most now they are electronic. A lot of them are kept electronically. But that is the tenets of those are the same because they're based off of regulation and the requirements for them. But each individual district creates its own ILP template, if you will. But the information would be the same for others.
And that is available?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McCormick.
Thank you, through the chair. Commissioner Bishop, one of the
three studies. So the conversation I just had was in reference to Representative McCormick's big button. And I believe that is part of propaganda that we're not allowed to do as legislators. So I want to take a brief at ease and call in legal. Representative McCormick doesn't want to remove it. And brief at ease. Calling the Education Committee back to order. Representative McCormick, you had a question.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Allard, if I may, just a moment, comment on the stoppage there. I just wanted to articulate.
Go ahead and say what you need to say, Representative McCormick.
Thank you, Chair Allard. I had a question. I'm not going to ask it now. Second question was, does the department support a raise to the BSA? Thank you.
I believe he also has comments, so when you're finished, I'm going to give him the grace of whatever comments he wants to make.
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative McCormick, yes, we would like to see investment made in public education.
Go ahead with your follow-up comments about your button.
Thank you, Chair Allard. I don't have any further comments. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. In the presentation from Mr. Jepson, there was information given about wait lists for charter schools. And I have tried to find that through the chair. I'm sorry if I failed to say that. I'm trying to find online more information. And I have a lot of questions about charter schools that I'm not able to get answered. So, for example, I know it's common practice in Anchorage to put your name on every charter school in the city and then you hope to get into one. So that could make your wait list a little inaccurate, but I'm not able to find that data. I also couldn't find how many families applied to charter school who weren't able to get in. I wasn't able to find how many charter schools have been denied by their local boards. I haven't been able to find how many charters are even feasible, as they're a carrying capacity in our state. We're so rural, I'm not sure that charter schools are going to work everywhere. There's a lot of information not available. So let's just drill down on the wait list question. When we say there are families on the wait list, are there at this time in the school year families still on wait lists, and what is that number and how do I find it?
Sure. Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemschut, yes, in the two districts for which I work that had the largest amount of charter schools, which would be Matsubara School District and the Anchorage Schools District, those data are held locally. And I do know in the Anchorage School District, it is an electronic system for which parents apply, but they apply for their first choice, and then they're on that first choice waiting list, if you will. The number, I don't have the exact, but it sounds very appropriate approximation from my experience in the Anchorage School District of about 2,000 children a year waiting on lists to get into charter schools. To your capacity or market share, if you will, I believe it really is just like our other schools that, you know, when it really relates to Representative Story's question, our amount of kids and how we service them and the best way that we can service them. I would just like to change the narrative to how do we best meet the needs of students and where does that occur? What matches that student's needs and that parent's needs? And so those choices would therein lie how districts operate.
Paula?
Yes, I just wanted to welcome Representative Staff for joining us today. Go ahead, Representative Hemschut. No, Representative Sharkey, are you here?
Galvin.
Oh, Elise Galvin, welcome.
Through the chair, I want to go back to that waitlist question. Are families allowed to apply to multiple charter schools? Could their name appear in multiple places until they get into either the one they want or one that's available?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemschut, you may have a first choice and a second choice, but as far as the overall numbers, we'd have to check, but the overall numbers of people waiting isn't generally per school. We would really have to dig into those data to find that answer in regard to how they're presented and held. But you do have to make a first choice, second choice.
Paula?
Thank you. Through the chair. So I'm a little frustrated that I can't find the information that I need to know. So I'll just ask you, since it's not publicly available on the deed site or somewhere, how many charter schools have been declined by their local boards?
Through Representative Allard to Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemschut. We do not collect those data at this time, indeed, so we don't have that answer.
Paula?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. So how many families right now have not been able to get into a charter school who would like to get into a charter school? Do we have a number? So you've talked about the wait list, and my concern is if you're an Anchorage family or a Matsu family and you have decided that any charter is better than no charter, and so you put your name on multiple lists, that could inflate what those lists look like. Can you help me understand that's not happening?
Sure. Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemschut, just as I shared, I don't have that piece of information. The 2,000 may just be single families waiting to get in, or children waiting to get in, or it may be multiples, but I can share that really it's not even just charter schools with wait lists. Specialty schools, special mission schools, whether they're neighborhood special mission schools or things like that, there's anything that really focuses on choice is highly sought after by families. And I would say that they all primarily have wait lists.
Well, we have, yes, I'm going to let you do a follow-up. We do have people waiting to testify, okay, as invited to us, public testimony.
So, testifying on this, not the CS, but on this bill.
on this particular bill, yes. So, if you could.
So through the chair, when you talk about waitlist, that's also for optional programs, magnet schools. It's not just the charter schools.
No, Sean. Back up front, please.
Through Representative Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute. Choice in public school is really sought after. So no matter what choice we're talking about, growing those choices is something that our public has asked us for. And given the success as shared in this presentation of charter schools specifically, that is a primary concern is to
be clear,
support districts.
The wait list that you talked about with 2,000 kids, is that charter schools or all schools of choice?
The wait list through Co-Chair Allard, through Representative Hemshute, the numbers for the wait list for specifically were for charter schools. The wait list for other schools probably grows.
Can we get some substantiation of those numbers?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Representative Hemshute, we can contact districts to be able to see if they give
that
us
that would be
those
very ones. Helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. Representative Ruffridge, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. I wanted to move to the section that's on the screen in front of us that labeled as Section 7, and I know that this is in a CS that we don't have in front of us, but with the READS Act, which you know, is obviously in a rollout, the department is engaged in at a high level. The $180 for every student K through 3 with a reading deficiency, can you describe what $180 would do for a child with a reading deficiency? Why would we have that labeled as something special? What would those dollars be used for? Is that something that is easily marked? If you could just speak to that reading deficiency and what someone's supposed to do in a school when a child has a reading deficiency.
Sure. Thank you. Through Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge. In so much as this has been in, presented the funding in other places, so I won't speak directly to these funds because this is in the CS, but in general, what we look to is to really support overall K-3 reading. I have shared that I wasn't a fan in just deficiency because as I shared a couple of weeks ago to this body, you saw how the numbers from being in the red zone deficient changed 15% up, but kids who were on grade level moved back. And so if you're only, you really want to look at supporting your whole process for supporting kids. These would include tutors, additional tutors after school, IRIPs, if you will, for students. We create individualized reading plans for students, and they look to additional services for kids. So it's not about being taken out of this group to put in this. It's being, you'll get your core reading and some more. And so it's for the some mores, if you will, the additional instruction through tutoring, as well as really supports for families that are written within the bill itself. The IRIP is a work with a parent. So whether it's support for parents to work at home as well with you or for tutoring, it really is to enable K-3 to focus and have the resources where it's most needed so that we can bring kids up to grade level by third grade before they're behind.
A couple follow-ups, thank you. So I guess thank you for that information. So if a child needed some additional tutoring and Section 7 in the CS is, you know, provided, how much tutoring does $180 provide? And then I guess a completely separate question, but still in Section 7, an additional $100 for K through 3 students in a Title I school. I'm concerned, and I think there's always still some questions about disparity tests, and if we're pushing additional state funds into just Title I schools, is there an issue there? Also, what is the evidence for additional funding just for Title I schools? So there's a lot of questions in there.
Sure. Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Ruffridge, through the Co-Chair Allard. So really, title programs of and of themselves come from the late 1960s, early 70s study that demonstrated, it's called Jinx and Jinx study, that demonstrated, that started this program. It used to be Chapter 1, but Title 1 is to it's evidencing, saying that what happens before school and some of those inputs for children success in school really is determined before school. But they come to you, and perhaps some of the, assets that kids could get if you're poor. There's different assets and inputs than if you're not poor in families. That's basically what that study showed. And the study demonstrated that depending on your socioeconomic, you grew at the same rate, but you just started below. That's the premise of Charter One or Title One. So we do have evidence today in our data that demonstrate the students, the greater amount of students that are in need of IRIPs and have reading deficiencies actually attend Title I schools. So they're in higher poverty areas. And so it doesn't mean that they can't read. It doesn't mean that they won't read. It just means that this is providing additional funds that may not be available in that area to really invest additional funds into students who may have grown up in an impoverished area.
Uh-huh. Yeah, please. Thank you. Sorry, there was a first question to all of that. So, and that is how much additional services does $180 provide? And I guess by contrast to that, how much does $280 provide if you're in a Title I school and you have a reading deficiency?
Sure. Thank you, through the chair, co-chair Aller, to co-chair Ruffridge. The programs are really determined through a system called multi-tiered system of success, and those inputs and charges would really be at the local level because of the local price of understanding what they're going to do. If I had one tutor with 10 students in need for after school, that's going to be a really per pupil different cost than one tutor needed for three kids. And so I believe that the additional funds are really for the additional students that may need to be served, because we do have evidence that the need is greater in title schools, or there's just more kids, more students that may need these services. But as insofar as what can you get with that money, it really depends. The IRIP itself and the law allows for some flexibility at the school level, not even the local level, but the school level, to determine how they are going to provide the additional inputs and services and teaching that kids might need, or the reteaching. And so their plans are varied. And so I really couldn't answer specifically, what am I going to get for my dollar? You're going to basically get an investment in that school to be able to have the flexibility for before and at, primarily this is going to go for before and after school services, so that kids are not taken out of other courses during the school year. And that was paramount in the reading bill.
Please. So instead of speaking specifically, given your wide range of experience, could you speak more generally, particularly, we've heard a lot about individualized reading plans. In my brief tenure of my tour of schools during the interim, talked with a lot of teachers who were trying to assess the time it takes to do an individualized reading plan. And it's significant. And there was some frustration on behalf of teachers for either not having the time, not having really people to do the after-school programs. So I'm wondering if you could, instead of speaking specifically, if these funds were given to you and you were in charge of a school district generally, how would you utilize them for kids that need a reading deficiency or have a reading deficiency and need extra support?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think I'm starting to understand the impetus for your question. So through Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge, I was a principal, so I'm going to share. I would put the money back. Some of the things that we learned this year already was that the teachers that understood the IRIPs and could work with them more successfully in understanding the reason behind them actually were provided additional professional development and time, and paid for their time to write those IRIPs. So I would invest directly into teachers to whether it's for understanding the whole entire, reading continuum, or specifically when they're not writing these during the school day because they're teaching during the school day. So I would pay teachers for the after-school work and doing each of these IRIPs. They're intense. They're not easy. Hence some of the decisions at the beginning of the year, and talking with really specifically the superintendent in Kenai, provided some ideas about how to adjust our regulations on these. But I would pay teachers. I would pay teachers to do the tutoring after school. So a lot of times, or additional aid. So just providing money to the people who were doing the work at the floor level of the school is where I would invest the funds. In addition, really having engagement opportunities for our families to engage with teachers and have the time and the funds to support that for teachers would be paramount as well. Really just to connect and at the school level, though, for me, it would be to pay the people who do the work.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. So I guess just wanted to, so you were speaking generally as a principal. Would you envision then these funds, instead of going, well, I guess passing through a district and then being given directly to principals in order to disperse as they see fit? Because I think from at least my understanding, principals really don't have a ton of control over how the dollars are spent. That's usually happening at a district level. So would you envision this being dollars that are given directly to a principal in a school to disperse, I guess, individually on their behalf?
Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge. I know that isn't necessarily part of this bill, but if I had to do the world, I think that I've, in my course and through some fellowships, really looked into Edunomics, and it's really utilizing the school as the base of where things happen with the people there at the school. And allowing that flexibility to be able to support what happens at that school and the empowerment of the teachers to understand how they get better and they get their school better. I think the evidence is there that local funding to schools to be able to provide and organize around a mission and an outcome that they'd like is actually empowering, and it works. And so I don't think, and as a commissioner, I get to say how districts spend their money, but I would say that I would encourage them to get it to the place where the work happens, which is at a school level.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just trying to make sure I understand really the process behind what Section 7 would do. So if Section 7 were passed into law today, the Department of Education would assess or get back information from districts on the number of children who have a reading deficiency, and then the number of students who have a reading deficiency in a Title I school. They would do the calculations, and then would that look like a block grant just put into a district? Or I think that's my question.
Thank you. Through Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge, I'd like to go on record first to say I don't think that we should pay for deficiencies. I would like funds to go to a system, because as I demonstrated earlier, the type of assessment that we use, actually kids move in and out of deficiency, not deficiency. So I would never want to just incentivize something we don't want to see to begin with. I would incentivize just good teaching of reading. If you think about it, teachers are the ones assessing the kids. We would never want to put them on the spot to say, keep a few more, or don't assess again, or, you know, there's so much variance there to put any pressure on kids not to do the best for students. Not that that would happen, but I just don't think we incentivize deficient. I think we incentivize good reading instruction and success in reading. But some districts have very well articulated supports for their schools. And so if that's the case, then I see those districts supporting their schools with those funds how they can. I would just hope that schools and at the classroom level and at the teachers doing the work, that is specifically supported with these funds for reading. Not, if you will, to go like, you know, when I give my kid money, like, or whatever, not to go in a gas tank, but to actually go to what it's specifically meant for is reading.
Last follow-up, I think. Thank you. So I guess the given that statement about not wanting to, incentivize a deficiency, would it be better? Because my question earlier was, do these dollars just come out as a block grant and then, you know, you just do the calculation? Would it be better to sort of take an assessment of where the state of Alaska is at with reading and how many ILPs might need to be done, or IRPs, and have a guess at how much dollars that would take, an educated guess, for districts to provide these additional services, and then just put that into the BSA, and then with instruction to say, use it like this, because it seems odd to break this out with your concerns, and then still just provide it as a block grant either way. So I guess I would wonder, why do you support Section 7? It sounds like maybe you don't. And if you don't, is there a better way to do it? And is that just putting it into funding in general?
Through Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge, I do support setting aside funding specifically for reading. Absolutely. I believe that it's a statement from the legislative body that reading is important, and the READS Act that was passed a couple of years ago, to say that we believe in it, we support it, and we're going to do it with these dollars. Because given in a general BSA, I don't necessarily think that it always does trickle down to the intended purpose. And for me, just from, my years of experience, the debates here have been more money, more accountability. And I think by specifying where you want your funds to go and the kinds of outcomes that we've already described in the READS Act that we want, this really takes care of that. Additional investment for additional outcomes. I would, if I had, especially back to your disparity test, I would say, how many K-3 students are in Alaska? And let's provide an amount to these K-3 students and these school districts so that they can assist their elementary schools, because that's where we want it to go to, their elementary classrooms in K-3 to do this work that was required by the READS Act. And then we trust, because we hold them accountable for the outcomes that we want, that they're going to use those funds specifically for those, and being this public, that they would utilize those funds for reading and support those K-3 teachers who have a big job, and we're looking at those every year, and supporting them and doing this work, I think, is the best bet, keeping it separate. But I would look at all K-3 students. As I shared, when I shared the data, about 15% of the students who were far below who would have needed an IRIP in kindergarten after 3 months were on grade level or moved out of that section. However, the kids on grade level, 25% of them moved down. This is a moving target because the goalpost keeps getting higher for kids. And so allowing schools the flexibility to address that seems to me to be the best bet. But I am thrilled that there's an investment in reading. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I have one more follow-up. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, so that was really helpful information. Thank you for providing that. So if I could just restate what I think you said, and you can tell me yay or nay. Instead of Section 7, it has a lot of language about certain people get this, certain people get that. Your opinion would be, let's say on average there's 10,000 kids per grade, so that's 40,000 kids in K-3. Let's say each one of those kids, qualifies for $200. We would just say it's $200 per kid to read better. And that's $12 million or whatever. So the legislature would set aside $12 million specifically for reading, and it goes to schools. Would that be then gone through the foundation formula, or it would just be each child, you have 100 kids in K-3, so you get, that amount. And it would be very specific. Is that what I heard you say?
Thank you. Through Co-Chair Allard to Co-Chair Ruffridge, I would like all kids to be supported, no matter, in those grade levels. How it runs through the formula is really different. It would allow smaller, districts to have and smaller schools to have additional funds, especially if they're in rural Alaska. But that would be a decision for your body. But specifically directing funds to the READS Act for students and allowing that flexibility of schools to figure that out and districts, I think is advantageous to this group and the success of children.
Good. Thank you. All right, so I'm going to go in for one last question before we move to public testimony. Do you believe opening up more charter schools would alleviate a waiting list or bring them down substantially?
Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Allard. I do believe that if we had additional charter schools to offer additional parent choice, that our wait lists in districts would go down.
Thank you. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to move into public testimony. Thank you for being here with me, Commissioner. I'll first see that if there is anyone in the room who would like to come forward, put their name on the record, and begin their testimony.
Chair Allard, is this on
the current bill?
HB 392?
Yes,
ma'am. Not the CS?
Yeah. No, it's public testimony on everything that they presented for 392. Is it 392? Yes. As long as it pertains to the bill, the person can testify with one. Go ahead and put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Co-Chair Allard and members of the House Education Committee. I'm Lon Garrison, the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to House Bill 392. ASB expresses a deep appreciation for the legislature's continued efforts to address public education issues, especially school funding. The legislative advocacy driven by resolutions of AASB are adopted each year by our membership at our annual meeting, and resolutions supporting this testimony are attached to my written statement, which have been submitted. ASB is supportive and thankful of the proposed $680 increase to the BSA, even though it is far less than the $1,413 that is needed to account for inflation since 2016. The increase in the statute would be a permanent investment in Alaska's students. Thank you. The proposed additional funding increases for public transportation will help prevent districts from utilizing funds that might otherwise go for instruction and student support. The additional funding for implementing the Alaska Reads Act is critical to its success and the significant impact it will have on all our students. Alaska's public charter schools are noted to be some of the best performing charters in the country. AASB believes the proposed appeal process for charter school terminations and the dedicated position at DEED supporting charter schools are needed improvements, and we advocate for efforts to enhance and support charter school applications through local school boards and the State Board of Education. ASB's membership is resolved that the formation of charter schools remains within the authority of local school districts and opposes any effort to enact other sole authorizers. Creating and operating effective schools is a complex task. It requires significant support from parents, community, and a local school district. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for being here. Is there anybody else in the room who'd like to come up and testify? All right, I'm seeing no one. We're going to go ahead and move to online testimony. Let's start with Rachel Posse. If you could put your name on the record and begin your testimony, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Rachel Posey, and I would like to thank the Education Committee for taking my testimony. I live in Anchorage in House District 15, and I'm calling to indicate my support for raising the BSA to 680 as included in this bill. Our schools need this permanent increase in funding so they can budget and plan for their coming years. I would like to raise concerns with the new language about a state board authorizing charter schools. I think that having that remain with our local school boards who are accountable to voters should be the priority. That's working well, and I don't see why we would change it at this point. But I just want to emphasize that putting education funding as a priority should be important to everyone. It brings money into our local economies, and it supports our kids and helps with the future workforce of the state. So thank you for bringing forward this potential BSA increase, and I hope that it passes. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to go back up. I apologize. Mr. Craig Wrighton, if you can go ahead and begin your testimony, you have 2 minutes.
Yes, good morning. For the record, I'm Chris Wrighton. I'm the superintendent with Craig City School District, and I want to thank the members of the House Education Committee for taking this testimony. I'm testifying in support of HB 392 because 392 provides critical support to our Alaskan public school system by providing the following. funding for school districts to increase internet speeds, increasing the base student allocation by 680, increasing funding for school transportation, increasing funding for correspondence homeschool students, and supporting the district's responsibilities to live into the Alaska Reads Act with integrity. I'm also testifying in cautious support of HB 392 due to language related to the operation of charter schools. My 30-year career has been steeped in district-developed school choice options for students and families. Charter schools provide a fundamental support for families across our state to support the specific needs and interests of some students. And I'm an advocate for locally developed school choice options, of which charter schools are one critical component. HB 392 provides support for school districts and, more importantly, the families school districts serve, because it provides funding for a charter school coordinator position at DEED to support districts and families' efforts to develop the most robust curricula options for our students statewide. I'm concerned about language within HB 392 that would allow DEED to override a school district if the school district disbanded a charter school, because this language oversteps the authority of elected school board members in governing their locally provided programs. In closing, I'm fully appreciative of the House Education Committee continuing these important conversations about how to stabilize our statewide educational system and ensure that we have the appropriate resources available for all of our students. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Laura Steele. If you could please put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Laura Steele, and I'm calling on behalf of myself to encourage your support for HB 392. I wanted to speak to the DSA specifically. An increase to the DSA is sorely needed, and I really appreciate all the efforts attempted in the budget to increase this amount to the approximately $1,400 needed to adjust for inflation. The $680 noted in this bill is not enough to keep up with inflation, but it is much, much better than nothing. As we saw several weeks ago, there's wide public support for an increase. Parents know it's needed. Students and teachers feel it. Investing in our state's children is an investment in our shared future and a path towards greater economic prosperity for our state. Again, I appreciate your willingness to make good on the promises made to Alaska students and families and appropriately resource our schools. We cannot afford another year of budget cuts. Please support HB 392. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Christina Turman. If you could please put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes. Is she still online? Christina Turman? We could come back to her.
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
There she is. Yep. Go ahead with your testimony, please.
I'm walking my kids to school right now, so I have it on mute. I am calling today from Fairbanks, Alaska, in support of this bill, or quite frankly, any bill that will provide the funding our public schools so desperately need. To me, SB 140 did that, but I realized it didn't do everything that our governor is demanding, and you all have a very hard job to do. I see this new bill as an attempt to make your constituents and your boss happy. I acknowledge that's not an easy job. I especially want to thank you for taking time for public testimony. Being someone from District 34, this is really important to me because we feel largely ignored and not advocated for by our own representatives and senator. Going into the SB 140 hearing, our senator released that he had over 650 emails, 95% of which were in favor of the override, and yet what he did was stand up, vote against it, and also...
Christina, can you please speak to the bill and not a different bill?
Sure, I'd love to. I guess what's super important to me right now is I'm just hearing a lot about needing to see like a return and some accountability. And so being from Fairbanks, I just don't feel like we're being represented well right now. And so what I want to make sure you guys know is I'm a parent. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm part of the community. And I've watched 4 schools now close in 3 years. I've seen orchestra, band, and art cut from elementary schools, class sizes increased, and teachers receiving pick slips year after year. And so this bill, yeah, there should be accountability. We want to see better results, but also we have a lot to just put back into our schools that's been taken away at this point. And I don't feel like that's been clearly articulated by our district representatives, at least. So I'm really, really hopeful that this bill can pass and we can get that BSA increase. To me, the worst thing right now would be to see another bill with one-time funding, because that would
just... Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Cody McKenna. If you could please begin your testimony, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, hi. This is Principal McKenna. So I'd like to address Chair Allard and the House Education Committee. I am the principal of Aurora Borealis Charter School here in Kenai, Alaska, a K-8 program. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. So I'd like to go through House Bill 392 real quick and talk about some things. First of all, I would like to put our opinion that the charter school approval process should stay as it is. It is very important. I'm a current part of our Kenai Borough School District process. We incorporate all of the charter school principals in that process to help charters get on their way. And so I would be in favor of keeping that process as it is. There's a lot of logistics involved with that process, so it's very important. Part of the biggest thing, part of the bill that needs to definitely get passed is Section 6, talking about an increase to the BSA. That 680 increase is a minimum increase that we need to operate as a charter school. Most of our funding comes through the BSA, and if that increase doesn't happen this year, we are going to be looking at making some cuts that we're not looking forward to doing. So that's the number one priority of 392 for us is Section 6. I've also heard lots of testimony about the increase for the Alaska Reads Act that is also needed. That is to help support that bill. A lot of that money would have to help students after school programs to help basically with their IRIPs, those individual reading plans. That is an important part. I don't think there should be a piece that goes with Title I. If you can't read and you need reading help, it has nothing to do with your finances. We just need to get support for those kids for after school. And I will also be, I've emailed you guys in the past. I'm going to email you guys again in the future. I heard a lot of testimony.
Thank you, Mr. McKenna, for your testimony. Next, we have Chandra Kafroy. Could you please put your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, my name is Chandra Kafroy. I'm calling to speak on charter schools and funding and for those things. I specifically have experienced over almost 2 years now wanting to get a charter school going in the Nikolaevist community. And that was in response to the public school. There's one there, there's K-12 that absolutely failed that community. The school district over the course of at least 11 years, if not more, that was tone deaf to the communities and parents' concerns. And has resulted in a drastic unenrollment of students from 180, a thriving school, state basketball champions, and so on, just an absolute hub of the community, down to at 1.4 children in the school building, and now they're projecting maybe 8 for next year. So we would like to see funding that is responsive to unique community needs and concerns. We want to see conditions and accountability put into legislation that funds anything at all. Charter schools need the same funding as other public schools. Charter schools are public schools currently, and they need the same funding. We would like to see, as I said, accountability built in and swift accountability. Currently, we have 80 children that wanted to attend our charter school almost 2 years ago, and they continue to be left out of the public school system and pushed into homeschool programs or over filled schools outside of their community. We would like to see NEA political and personal agendas of teachers left out of the classroom. And then let's see. I think a lot of the concerns that parents are discussing is just that you see evidence of that, the mass exodus of families taking.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Gabe Perrone. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Gabe. Just a second. He's coming. Go ahead.
They're all calling him for anchor point. That's fine.
Go ahead.
state your name.
Okay, my name is Gabe Crown.
Eli, you need to do that.
Go ahead and begin your testimony.
I think that we should be able to have a charter school because of many reasons. But the first being that that we can have a different curriculum and be able to learn a little more things closer to our culture. And I play a lot of sports, and basketball is one of the main ones. But they don't offer it. Like this year, they ended up stopping. They had a team, and there were three kids on it. So yeah, they couldn't. I play a lot. However, my parents have to drive me 45 minutes in the Celtics for basketball, and that costs a lot. If I wanted to go to Homer, it would still be 30 minutes in Homer. I think many kids have lived around the village, haven't had the opportunity to join sports they really enjoy. I'm sure that the charter school can give those opportunities for the young kids and the future kids. The reason for there not being sports is because nobody wants to go to the school they have, and many people would join the charter school, and many people would play sports. The school has much more potential than what is being used, and that's why I think we should have the charter school.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Ellie Caroni. If you could please put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes and begin your testimony.
I think we should have... Eli,
go ahead, please.
I think we should have the charter school because we have recently been in a co-op instead, and if we cannot have the charter by next year, we will not be able to do school at all. We'll probably cancel the co-op and all, and most of the students would have to be homeschooled. I find it annoying how hard these parents work to build this charter / co-op. They still haven't got it yet. I don't think any of our teachers are getting paid for the countless hours they've been teaching and creating lectures for us. But if we had the charter school, that may change it. And also, I think it'd be nice to be able to have sports. And there's been probably around 100 students that would also be going to the charter school that have been waiting for it to be open.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Annalian Kuzmin. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Annalian Kuzmin. We are so thankful for the charter school.
Could you please speak closer to the mic so that we could hear you?
We are so thankful for the charter school because it's in our village or it's close to our house. Plus, my mom and dad know what they're teaching us in the charter school. And they can also pick what we learn and study. The teachers that are teaching us right now, our homeschool moms, that are teaching us and using their time and money. It's affordable and private. Classes is smaller than public schools. We only have 2 classrooms, but we can get a go on another field trip. We want to have a charter school so we can learn to study. Charter schools let you have more educational freedom. Life in charter schools are normally smaller than public schools, so they can personalize your learning plan and help you take classes that you are interested in. The public school students are assigned to the schools based on their neighborhood. Only about 12% of U.S. public school students attend charter schools, and charter schools promote a safer and stronger community. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Alistair Kuzman. If you could put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes.
My name is Alistair Kuzman. People who create charter schools believe they increase the learning opportunities to provide a greater access to quality education. One of the best benefits is that parents know what their kids are getting taught and are great to count for school, which is good because the homeschool I did before did not count. Charter schools are normally smaller than public schools. Parents are normally more involved in the kids' education. Charter schools promote safer, stronger communities. Charter schools are affordable and public. There are only 12% of U.S. public school students that attend charter schools. We may only have 2 classes at the moment, but we may grow in numbers and have more in the future.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Natalie Purvost. If you could please put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes.
Natalie?
Yes.
So we need the charter school because the charter school is focusing on the subjects that matter to the students enrolled. And there's a small amount of students, which means the teacher can focus more on the students that need help. And charter schools also have high academic standards. The charter school also brings a lot of extra activity that you most likely would not learn in a public school. Another thing is charter school gives parents a second chance. And so charter schools, it's more hands-on activities. Charter school lets you have an educational freedom. Charter schools can also personalize your learning plan and help you take classes you're interested in that a public school would not offer. Many charter schools have far exploration rates than traditional public schools. Charter schools subject matches with the students enrolled. The charter school can get funded, and we can exclude even more activities. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Leo Ellsworth. If you could please put your name on the record, you have 2 minutes.
My name is Leo Ellsworth.
Go ahead and begin your testimony.
Okay. I believe that we should be allowed to go to a charter school for a few reasons. Charter schools give opportunities for kids to do the sports they love, and charter schools will give the kids a good future, more of an opportunity for the school. Many kids that go to the charter, or go to a charter in school, now they have an opportunity to talk and be social to the other kids. Good thing about having it. Okay. School will have more kids and will be used to its potential. And with a charter school, you can play any sport you want and use the things the school has that haven't been used in a while. For example, the soccer field. The state should be in charge of charter schools instead of by a school district. And those are the reasons why I believe the charter school benefits the kids and the parents.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jessica Vanderreel. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony, you have 2 minutes.
Sure. Hi. Thank you for taking my testimony. It's Jessica Vaudre, and I'm in Shishmaref. Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, if I may say so through the chair, I don't understand why there's such a focus on condemning or scrutinizing programs that are actually working. You know, say these words like monitoring, and you know, it seems like you want to pro-manage correspondence programs and these other programs that are actually working. The reason they're working is because the parents are involved. These are publicly funded families, and they need to be left alone to do what they're doing. that can't be done in the public school, which is, you know, I mean, there's this constant data mining going on. That's all schools are these days. It's just mining data, testing, compliance, monitoring, big government, you know, paperwork, reporting. And that's one reason why teachers can't get the job done to just teach. And now you've got these kids in correspondence schools, and parents are actually able to just teach their kids, read good books, you know, wholesome material, you know, and kids are learning. And if you look at numbers that show, you know, comparisons between publicly funded families and students, the huge difference. Proof is coming out that correspondence programs are working, and they're more successful than, what did you call it, neighborhood schools. You know, yeah, there needs to be choice. And I don't know why the union is so against school choice. Why? Why does there have to be such a monopoly? Why does all the funding need to go and do it your way? You know, where the captive audience is, they're leaving. You know, Moses is paving the Red Sea. He's, you know, the Exodus is happening, you know, and, you know, good luck stopping that, Representative Hemshoot. It's not going to work. All these scheming union politics.
Miss Jessica, could you please keep it to the bill and not?
Have a great day.
Thank you. Next, we have Jacqueline Muehlbauer. If you could please put your name on the record. You have 2 minutes. Sorry about that, Representative Hemshoot. I didn't catch it in time.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Muehlbauer from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I was calling in to ask for support for a BSA increase for our local schools. The recent override of the governor's veto has made us, our local school district, close one school and more potentially. I would really appreciate the House Education Committee considering a BSA increase of at least 680, if not more. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Oops. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. For those watching online that did not get a chance to testify, you could submit your written testimony on HB 392 to the committee, which is house.education@aklake.gov, and it will be uploaded into the record.
Representative Allard?
Go ahead, Representative.
Question. Since the CS is not before us,
I want to announce that really quick. So we did receive the CS. You guys will get that today. And then we're going to move on to my next bill.
My question was, I am asking to have public testimony opened again on the CS once people know what's in the CS.
I don't believe I'll be chairing that week, but you can probably take that up with the co-chair.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And so now we're going to have a hearing presentation that HB 392 is done, and we will move an amendment deadline for Sunday, the 31st of March at 5 p.m. Our second item on today's agenda is the committee substitute for Senate Bill 29, Civics by Senator Stevens. Before the committee, this is the first hearing on the bill. Would the sponsor please come up to the table?
Is that deadline for 392 not the CS?
Let me finish reading this and I can answer your question after committee meeting, or I'll repeat it at the end. Thank you. And please state your name on the record and present your bill. I just wanted to add that you do have invited testimony here today. Lisa Bordeaux, Director of State Policy. And we also had John Pugh from former Chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast. And thank you to the President of Senate for joining us. This is a pleasure. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for hearing this bill. A small bill in many ways, but a very important one. You know, there's been a quiet epidemic, I think, in this country over the years, sort of apathy and actually division. For decades, we have focused on other issues other than civics education, and certainly those have all been good issues. Math, science, reading, writing, all those are important, but we've done that at the expense of social studies. So other states have certainly taken notice of this and have done things to make adjustments, changing curriculum, including exit exams in civics, observing flag etiquette. Madam Chair, your experience as a former military person, you know how important that is. Community involvement, volunteerism, registering to vote, leadership workshops are just a few examples of where other states have gone. Senate Bill 29 is one effort among many needed to help restore our faith and our understanding of our form of government, especially by our younger citizens. The bill calls for the creation of a civics curriculum, and it creates a required exam or completion of a course in civics education for graduating seniors. I just want to make sure you know this is not a high-stakes exam. It's a high-stakes issue, but not a high-stakes exam. Students can take it repeatedly until they reach a minimum passing grade of 70%. Madam Chair, I took it 100 questions. The exam we give to new citizens. I taught the University of Alaska for many years, professor of history, and I missed some questions, particularly when I came to Supreme Court. Missed it the first time. I got them right the second time. So the point is that it's a learning experience. So you can miss a couple of questions, you go back and take it again, and you learn something along the way. That's the whole point of it. What this bill does, Madam Chair, is it tasks the State Board of Education Early Development with reviewing and modernizing our state standards for civics. It requires them to develop the state board to develop a curriculum and ways to assist districts in providing this, aligning our education with those civic standards. The point is, I hope that this bill will rekindle the spirit within our education system of helping to foster citizenship, of helping future generations and younger generations become voters, participating, community engagement, and those are all fundamental purposes of the very reason we have education in this country by our founding fathers was to create citizens. That's the whole point. Educate your citizenry so they can participate and they can vote and they can run for office like you have. A small bill, but really I think one very much needed. Madam Chair, I have to apologize. I have to get prepared for the floor session that's coming up shortly here, but Tim Lampkin is here and can answer any of your questions, and I appreciate that you're considering this today.
Thank you for joining us today, Senator Stevens. It's always our privilege. Would you like anybody else to come up, or are there any committee questions towards Senator Stevens? Oh, Representative Story, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ellerton. Thank you, President Stevens, for being with us today. My question is, you have a 70% cut score, so I was wondering how you came up with the cut score. And then why is it so important to have a test, that they have to pass a test? Why can they not just, the districts have to give this test and want kids to get a 70% cut score, but that they won't get their diploma without it?
Very good question. Thank you, Representative Story. Understand they can take a class without and not take the test. So if they take the class, if they pass the class, they will not have to take a test at all. The test is one we give to all new citizens. Anyone coming into this country, we expect them to understand what it means to be a citizen. And I believe, Tim can go into specifics, but I believe it would be like a 20, 25 questions. You wouldn't get a whole 100 questions. I did pass the test out to the entire Senate a few years ago and told them to take the test and return them to me, and I would grade them. Nobody returned it to me at all. Yeah. The point is that, you know, there are some tough questions there, but it's a learning process, you know. Again, not a high-stakes test because you can take it as often as you need it, but even better is to take a class. And so that's what we're asking the department to do, is prepare a class for these students as well.
A follow-up? Please. Thank you for that explanation. Having the department do the curriculum, that's great as an option. But I noted in the fiscal note, there isn't a fiscal note for districts to be able to provide a staff person for a part-time class.
Yeah, I'm glad to answer that because it's one that really annoys me. Every time I have dealt with anything in education, the first thing you hear is an unfunded mandate. Now, wait a minute. We're giving billions to education. We can expect our departments, our school districts, our teachers to provide basic education, which is citizenship. So I think that's just a responsibility of the Department of Education, responsibility of the budget we give to them. And Tim, maybe you can respond to that as well.
For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. First, as regards the cut scores, this test is based off of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security Immigration Services exam that's given to folks that want to seek citizenship. It's been on the books for decades. That test is 120 questions. They randomly choose 20 of them. And a passing score for the feds is 60%. The original version of this bill had that same figure, but our finance committee, the other body, felt that 70%, which educators are generally in our grading system, 70% is a C minus. That was considered a minimally reasonable passing score. As regards the fiscal note, I'm going to, of course, defer to the department to defend their fiscal note and explain that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Hemchu.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, is this the test?
That's it. Have you taken it?
Just right now. Like Tom Brady is one of the answers. So anyway. So my question is, do you know where Homeland Security, which standards were they using when they created the test? Like who decided this is what kids need to know?
Well, it's not kids, of course. It's any entering citizen, anybody who's applying for citizenship.
Right.
A follow-up?
Yes, through the chair. Who decided what entering citizens need to know? How did they arrive at these questions?
Through the chair, Tim Lampkin, Representative Hemshoot, this was developed federally. I can dig into the specifics as to who exactly, if you want a name, but I do know that the Immigration Services referred to or was consultation with U.S. Council on Social Study Educators. Or there's a body of similarly named out there that was deferred to in the development of this that test. That program, it's readily available on the internet.
So I'm going to go ahead and interject, if you don't mind. We do have one of your invited testimony calling in for DC, and I do want to give her that opportunity. But before we go there, Senator Bishop and I had the pleasure of having breakfast together, and he passed your test with 100%. So I think that is noted, and I think that is a good thing.
Not the first time, Madam Chair. I'd have to look into that.
I think we are correct. So right now we're going to have your invited testimony, Ms. Lisa Boudreau from Washington. She is the Director of State Policy of iCivics and 6X Now. So if you can please begin your testimony and introduce yourself. Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the two co-chairs and the other honorable committee members for allowing me to testify. I'm really grateful to be here. My name is Lisa Boudreau, and I serve as the Director of State Policy for Civics Now, and it's a project of iCivics. Before addressing the merits of Senate Bill 29, I just want to share a little bit more information about my organization and why we think this issue is so urgent, and a little bit more about what solutions exist. Civics Now is the nation's largest cross-partisan coalition focused on stronger state and federal K-12 civic education policy. Our coalition works across the aisle to pass research-based nonpartisan policies that have attracted bipartisan support across states. Since 2021, 20 states have adopted 22 policies aligning with our policy recommendations. I track state policy across the nation that's focused on civic ed, and I do an annual policy scan to learn what states are doing, and I publish those findings on our website so that policymakers and educators can see what's happening. This year, I'm tracking 129 different bills across 33 states related to civic education. We're all here because it's fair to question the extent to which Alaskans are prepared for informed, effective, and lifelong civic engagement. Civics has been neglected over the past 50 years, as Senator Stevens indicated. The Council of Chief State School Officers estimates that 44% of school districts have cut back on instructional time over the last 20 years. There's an Annenberg Civic Knowledge Study, which you guys can read in my written testimony. I won't go through that now. I'll just try to skip through so I can meet the time limit. To the extent to which our school districts are offering Civics University to every student in the classroom is of great concern. And it's not just a concern to researchers and advocates, but to parents too. Last fall, a conservative pollster gauged public support for K-12 civic education. He sampled about 3,000 adults, and overall, they demonstrated strong support for more emphasis on civics. Specifically, Republicans, 64% of Republicans thought that that civics in school should be emphasized more, and 66% of Republicans thought that civics is more important than it was 5 years ago. So what does these numbers tell us? They tell us that public and parental support for more time on civics in school is there. State legislatures other than Alaska have taken notice, and I just want to highlight a few. Republican Governor of New Hampshire passed the More Time on Civics bill, which required, of course, tests and more time in elementary school and middle school. There was a bill in Utah passed by Republican Governor that dedicated $1.5 million to pilot evidence-informed local innovations.
and there are more in my testimony. We've studied this issue, and we offer the most promising long-term plan and recommendation. The key to our policy recommendation is really simple. We need to spend more time on civics in school. While there are existing Alaska civics course standards that are critical, only a course time requirement can guarantee that students will walk away with the knowledge, skills, and dispositions necessary to gain the knowledge and the concrete skills that come from high-quality civic education. I'm here to testify in support of SB 29. This bill would create course time in high school and a civics test for high school graduation. While our group would recommend tweaking the assessment options to be more focused on a project-based assessment, for example, so students can demonstrate their civic knowledge and skills, we overall still support this bill's approach. Dedicated course time on civics is the answer to what ails our nation. My parent organization is called iCivics. It was founded by Sandra Day O'Connor, the late Supreme Court Justice. It's in her legacy that we do this work. I wanted to acknowledge that we're already investing our time by working with directly with the Alaska Council of School Administrators, the Civic Engagement for Rural Alaskan Students, Alaskan Staff Development Network, and various tribal councils to create online resources and training. This initiative will help teachers get the much professional development they need when this bill is passed. Teachers have a hard time getting here, as you know, because they're teaching in the classroom right now, but I'd like to just point to last year's Senate hearing on SB 29, where we had two teachers from the Alaska Council for Social Studies testifying in support of this legislation. Thank you so much for the committee's time and attention, and I welcome any questions that you have. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your invited testimony. I'm going to go ahead and go to the next invited testimony, if you can hold your question to the end, Representative Prox. So next we have John Pugh, from former Chancellor of University of Alaska. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Oh, hello. Come on up. If you could put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Pugh. I'm former Chancellor of University of Alaska Southeast, where I've served for 26 years, 16 as the Chancellor. I also served 14 years in the Department of Health and Social Services, four of those as Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as I was in the U.S. Air Force for 4.5 years prior to that. I have a lot of government experience and have had a lot of experience with students as well over those years. And so I am in support of SB 29 from both my personal experience as well as from my professional experience over the years in the various positions that I've served for the state of Alaska. One of the things I think is so important in this bill is that, you know, knowledge, you know, about government and how it works and key documents that formed our government, as well as, you know, information about elected officials and non-elected officials, as well as the various departments that are there, is very important for individuals to be able to engage in their civic responsibilities. This bill hopefully will provide that as we develop the curriculum so that individuals can become, have the tools that are in the toolbox to be able to be good citizens. One of the things that over the years in the university, there's strong research showing that individuals who do have this knowledge, who take coursework in political science and government, that they do engage more than others who do not. I have specific examples of that over the years at the university. Individuals who have been active in political science and government courses are also active in student government. They're active in the student clubs. They're in leadership positions at the university. They are in the legislative internship program here at the university. Dozens of them have participated in that legislative internship program. Many of them are staffers. There's one sitting next to me, Tim, very active. And one of them is our U.S. Congresswoman right now, who was in the internship program. So I have those examples are at the university level, but they definitely extrapolate to students at the high school or secondary level as well. Kids who get knowledge and engagement in civics at an early age do carry forward and become voters, become participants in their local, state, and the federal government. In closing, I'd say that clearly this bill alone will not stop the decline in young people voting. That's clear. That as the Senator Stevens mentioned, that
this is only one small bill. But I think that together with your House Bill 392, new funding, strengthening the quality of our public education system, this bill can also move us along to having more engagement of individuals in our civic activities.
Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to just caution the committee we do have for this morning, and if you just keep your questions at a minimum, that would be appreciated. And I think Representative Prox was first, and then I want to go to Representative Ruffridge. No?
That's all right.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Allard. Just a brief question. Support the intent of the bill. I was wondering if there was a possibility to include or talk about, because this is more of a national civics conversation, including, and I know the bill has portions in there about Alaska Native government, but what about state government? And would that be included in the civics education components, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. That is certainly something agreeable. I don't know that there's going to be any wrong answers to this. The ultimate goal and the keeping our eye on the ball is to improve our young people's participation and understanding of what it is to be a citizen. So state government format is certainly appropriate in that context.
Thank you.
Any other? Go ahead, Representative Story.
A couple questions through the chair. First one, and thank you, former Chancellor Pugh, for being with us today. It's good to see you. But my question is for Mr. Lampkin. It says that the effective date is July 1st, 2024, and the curriculum needs to be developed by the board because it might be used. So will that timeline work out, or does that need to be like a 2025 for implementation?
Through the chair, Representative Story, so thank you for that question. So as if or when we were to go take up the sectional at the conclusion of that, I was going to point out that 2024 was as of last May. This bill's been dormant since last year, and so therefore it may be a consideration to make that either 2025 or perhaps even 2026. We're flexible on that per the recommendations or requests of the department.
I thank you for that. One other clarifying question, mm-hmm. if I may follow up. I thank you through the chair. I'm a little confused. President Stevens testified that you could take the class or you could take a test if you didn't take the class. And I don't know if when I look at it, it says a district may use the curriculum in section, the first section one, to educate students. And then in section B, it says you may not get a secondary school diploma unless the student has completed one semester using the curriculum developed under A, which is the state curriculum, has achieved a passing score. That's confusing to me, because if they just take a class, then it sounded like you could take a test or you could take a class.
Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you for the question. To clarify, if we read the bill text carefully on page 2, line 3, under one, you take the class. Number two, you take the test. Or three, you have a disability and waiver. So any of those three will allow you to continue. That's a key distinction, is that it's take the class or take the test or get a waiver.
Quick follow-up and then we'll...
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So just confirm it. So you do not need to take the class. You could just take the citizenship test and get a passing score.
Through the chair, Representative Story, that is correct.
Okay, and my last follow-up. Has President Stevens considered... as testimony we heard from when we heard this bill prior, that project-based learning is how kids really are motivated in civics, and would he consider project-based rather than having a test as a mandate?
Through the chair, Representative Story, most certainly that is presumed to occur. We are trying to be somewhat cautious to not be overly prescriptive as we approach this process, this project.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so what I'm going to do is go ahead and set Committee Substitute Senate Bill 29 aside. We will readdress it with public testimony in our amendments. We clearly ran out of time, so my apologies to President Stevens. And that concludes our business for today. House Education Committee will meet again on Monday, April the 3rd at 08 o'clock.